The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
I'm Mo Rocca, and I've got a brand new podcast. It's all about the people who have long fascinated me. The one thing they've got in common? They're all dead. The name of my brand new podcast? Mobituaries. From the 20th century's greatest entertainer.
He was everything. I mean, he could play any instrument. He could dance like a maniac.
To the founding father, who just doesn't seem to get much respect.
This guy did everything wrong. So there's no statue, there's no signature on the Declaration of Independence.
You'll learn new things about people you thought you knew.
Were you aware that the day of your inauguration, Audrey Hepburn died?
No.
You'll learn about people who aren't real.
They did not have room in the writing for the older brother because the Fonz became the older brother.
So join me this premiere season of Mobituaries.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
A top North Korean official comes to Washington.
The Trump administration has been eager to set up the second summit.
And the latest on the government shutdown's impacts.
We're living on our savings account right now.
And now, from the Capital One Bank Studios in the CBS News Washington Bureau, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Let's start this weekend with North Korea. The country's former spy chief and negotiator Kim Jong-chol met Friday with President Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in Washington and at the White House. Here's CBS Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan.
The Trump administration has been eager to set up the second summit, which we expect to be in February. And my sources have said most likely in Vietnam, though they have also looked at Thailand as a possible location.
This weekend, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was supposed to be traveling to Europe and Afghanistan, but on Thursday, the president announced the trip and blocked her and other members of Congress on the trip from using government aircraft. Pelosi says alternate arrangements on commercial aircraft were also scrapped.
An aide to the House Speaker says the administration leaked Nancy Pelosi's commercial travel plans. The White House calls the charge a flat-out lie. Pelosi scrapped the trip, citing a State Department assessment that the disclosure of the destination endangered her, her traveling colleagues, and the U.S. military and security staff on the ground.
We had a report from Afghanistan that the president outing our trip had made the scene on the ground much more dangerous.
The White House says Pelosi should remain here to negotiate an end to the shutdown. Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, The White House.
It follows Pelosi's letter to the president asking him to delay his State of the Union address to Congress on January 29th until the government reopens. A busy travel weekend as the prolonged government shutdown takes its toll on federal workers off the job or out of money, including those who work for the TSA.
Frustration boiled over for airport screeners protesting in Dallas. The TSA administrator now confirms the spike in sick calls is due to officers who can no longer afford to work for free. This new food bank at the Tampa airport saw about 60 federal employees in its first 90 minutes. And in Orlando, people are dropping off donations, neighbors helping furloughed neighbors.
I really feel for them, and they shouldn't have to go through this.
Among the roughly 420,000 working without pay include members of the Secret Service, Border Patrol, and the Coast Guard. Just blocks from the White House, the line was steady outside this 2019 shutdown version of a soup kitchen for unpaid government workers and their families. World Central Kitchen, started by celebrity chef Jose Andres, usually deploys volunteer chefs after natural disasters.
This is not a disaster that we would thought we would normally deploy to.
Organizers there expect to feed some 2,000 people a day for the rest of the shutdown. Air traffic controllers lost a motion in court trying to halt the shutdown. And the city of Atlanta is worried about the shutdown's impact for the Super Bowl, particularly when it comes to TSA screening lines. Chris Van Cleve, CBS News, Reagan National Airport, Virginia.
Beyond Washington, in Ogden, Utah, with one of the highest concentrations of federal workers, including many at the IRS, are feeling the pinch. That's where correspondent Carter Evans talked to folks affected by the shutdown.
Sandwiched between federal buildings, normally bustling businesses like Anna Davidson's restaurant are now practically empty.
Every week that it goes on longer, it gets slower.
Business is down by half, forcing her to dig into savings to pay her employees. Furloughed IRS employee Emily Roush has gone from dining downtown to delivering meals for DoorDash, driving a car with a broken heater, and taking home a quarter of her normal salary.
It's not
going to pay all the bills, but at least it's going to buy us groceries and put gas in our vehicles.
With so many not getting a paycheck at all, Ogden Mayor Mike Caldwell says the local economy is struggling.
People that would typically come down here and go to movies and take their families out are finding ways they can really cut their expenses.
Ogden might have to do that too. Declining sales leads to a loss of tax revenue, which could mean cutbacks for this city of nearly 90,000.
It could be in the millions of dollars, which would be devastating for a community our size. So it's a big, big deal.
A big deal with no end in sight. Carter Evans, CBS News, Ogden, Utah.
Attorney General nominee William Barr appears on track to be confirmed by the Senate after he faced questions about how much independence he'd allow Special Counsel Robert Mueller in the Russia probe.
Attorney General nominee William Barr's nomination hearings was one dominated by questions like this.
Do you believe Mr. Mueller would be involved in a witch hunt against anybody?
I don't believe Mr. Mueller would be involved in a witch hunt.
The big focus Tuesday on Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into possible Russia meddling in the 2016 election.
If the president orders the attorney general to halt a criminal investigation for personal reasons, would that be prohibited under your theory?
I think it would be a breach of the president's duties to faithfully execute the law. It'd be an abuse of power.
Barr did send an unsolicited memo to DOJ officials last summer. He argued Mueller's obstruction theory is fatally misconceived and legally insupportable.
It sounds like it was an effort on your part to ingratiate yourself with an administration which is now nominating you for attorney general.
I can assure you I was not trying to ingratiate myself with anybody.
Barr, who served as attorney general once before under President George H.W. Bush, is expected to be confirmed. It requires a simple majority in the Senate, where Republicans hold a six-seat advantage. Mark Liverman, CBS News.
According to a report by BuzzFeed News, President Trump directed his longtime attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about efforts to build a Trump Tower in Moscow.
Back in November, Cohen admitted that he lied to Congress when he said those Trump Tower talks ended in January 2016, when in fact they ended 6 months later. Now BuzzFeed News is reporting that Special Counsel Robert Mueller has uncovered evidence that the president directed Cohen to lie to Congress, raising new questions about whether the president sought to suborn perjury or obstruct this investigation. According to the BuzzFeed report, two unnamed federal law enforcement officials say Mr. Trump was also in favor of making a trip to Russia during the 2016 campaign to meet Russian President Vladimir Putin.
First of all, I don't know Putin, have no business whatsoever with Russia.
During the campaign, then-candidate Trump repeatedly denied having any business dealings with Russia. He then backtracked those statements last year.
We had a position to possibly do a deal to build a building of some kind in Moscow. I decided not to do it. The primary reason, there could have been other reasons, but the primary reason, it was very simple. I was focused on running for president.
These revelations about Cohen's testimony come just a day after Cohen confirmed reports that the president directed him to pay thousands of dollars to a technology expert to rig online polls in his favor ahead of the 2016 campaign. The president has previously denied he directed Cohen to commit any crimes. We'll hear a lot more from Cohen when he testifies before Congress next month, before heading to prison in March to serve a three-year sentence for campaign finance violations. We reached out to the president's current personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, about this story, and he told us, quote, if you believe Cohen, I can get you a great deal on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Correspondent Paula Reed reporting from the White House. Coming up, the impact of a deadly attack in Syria on the U.S. exit from the country. That's next on the Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
On Thursday, President Trump visited the Pentagon responding to an explosion in Manbij, Syria, that killed and injured U.S. troops, for which ISIS took credit.
President Trump visited the Pentagon Thursday to discuss U.S. missile defense policy.
Our goal is simple, to ensure that we can detect and destroy any missile launched against the United States anywhere, anytime, any place.
The president also weighed in on Wednesday's suicide bombing in Syria. The attack killed four Americans, two of them soldiers and two civilians.
These are great people. great, great people.
ISIS claimed responsibility for the bombing in a restaurant frequented by Americans.
We have won against ISIS.
Just weeks ago, President Trump announced that he was withdrawing all U.S. troops from Syria.
The last thing we want to do is back out of this fight. What we should do is recommit ourselves to help the Syrian people.
There are approximately 2,000 U.S. troops currently in Syria. Mola Lenghi, CBS News, The White House.
More from correspondent Charlie Daggett in eastern Syria.
While President Trump and Vice President Pence continue to insist that ISIS is defeated in Syria, the front lines tell a much different story, with U.S. forces and their allies on the ground battling a persistent enemy that refuses to surrender.
Even as we made our way to the fighting, we were warned that ISIS terror cells lurked among the ruined villages, launching counterattacks and planting bombs on the only road in and out. We're now traveling to the front lines in the east of the country, the very last pockets of ISIS resistance. Now, once these areas are taken back, ISIS will no longer be considered a territorial force here. We arrived at Ashraf to see Kurdish-led forces firing a barrage of mortars toward ISIS positions, not much more than a mile away. And nearby, vital reinforcements, U.S. troops and military hardware. Not more than a few hundred yards away is where you find an American position fighting right beside forces here, and they've been firing mortars in that direction essentially since we got here. How important is it for you to have American forces on the ground fighting right beside you? They're playing a very big role, Commander Simko Shkak told us. Their forces have been very effective. We give them coordinates for ISIS locations, and their air force and artillery do all they can. In addition to roughly 2,000 U.S. ground forces here, the American-led air campaign has been pummeling this territory. 575 airstrikes on 1,100 targets during the first 2 weeks of this month alone. Concentrated on a sliver of land still under ISIS control.
Commanders here tell us that final push could take a month or more, but as the tragic deaths of four Americans and more than a dozen others in Manbij shows, ISIS has already morphed into an insurgency that's begun striking targets far beyond these battlefields. Charlie Daggett of CBS News in eastern Syria.
Political dysfunction across the pond following a defeat in Parliament of Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan. Here's correspondent Vicky Barker in London.
This was Theresa May, fresh from surviving a no-confidence vote in Britain's Parliament.
I would like to invite the leaders of parliamentary parties to meet with me individually.
Mr. Speaker. That's right, the control-freak Prime Minister finally offering what lawmakers have been demanding all along, consultations on a new Brexit deal. But the opposition Labour Party's refusing to meet her unless she takes a no-deal Brexit off the table, something she says she can't legally do. And there's still no majority for any of the Brexit scenarios. And the Brexit clock is ticking. Vicky Barker, CBS News, London.
Also in England, the Queen's husband, Prince Philip, has survived a car crash. More from correspondent Jonathan Vigliotti.
Prince Philip's Land Rover came to a screeching halt on its side. The force of impact shattered the windshield and jolted the 97-year-old prince, who was behind the wheel and strapped into the driver's seat. One witness said Philip was lightly bleeding and appeared very shocked, but was pulled from the wreck with the help of a bystander.
I helped him move his legs, which were a bit trapped. It was all a bit crushed. And then I saw his face and I realized who it was.
Two women in a second vehicle were hospitalized with minor injuries. A nine-month-old baby was found uninjured in the back seat. Many people were surprised to hear Philip was behind the wheel to begin with.
Prince Philip is, as we know, a very determined, headstrong individual who has wanted to retain a sense of independence right up until the age of 97. This is also a man who served in the Navy, who served in the Second World War, a man who has seen action. He's been very active a lot of his life.
But over the years, he's had to dial it back, giving up flying planes and playing polo. In 2017, he retired from his royal duties. Driving has remained a source of pride. He drove the Obamas and his wife, Queen Elizabeth, around their home in Windsor.
I have to say, I have never been driven by a Duke of Edinburgh before.
Prince Philip is said to be resting at home with Queen Elizabeth by his side. Buckingham Palace is taking this seriously, and some believe the prince will lose his right to travel on public roads. Jonathan Vigliotti, CBS News, Sandringham, England.
Back home, a 22-year-old man has died after he was buried in an avalanche in Taos, New Mexico. He was one of two people pulled from the snow by rescuers. More from KRQE-TV reporter Marissa Lucero.
Hundreds of people, EMTs, ski patrol, and other skiers sprung into action, creating lines down the mountain to find and save the two people buried.
The other avalanche victim is reported to be in critical condition. Deadly flooding out in California. At least six dead as torrential rains flooded roadways, downed trees, and sent massive boulders tumbling down hillsides. Even emergency workers found their vehicles pummeled by rocks from this powerful storm. Neighborhoods scorched by recent wildfires were evacuated. Some streets in Malibu were completely impassable. Further east, debris from one of the burn areas rushed through a community, but caused only minor damage.
Here in Southern California, 4 days of heavy rains has raised the concern that the ground underneath these houses along the canyons has been saturated and weakened, posing a risk not only for them, but also for the houses down below.
Up in the mountains, nearly 5 feet of new snow. The state has taken a pounding, and forecasters say this monster storm is now heading east. Don Daler, CBS News, Los Angeles. That storm's adding more problems to roads, rails, and airports along the East Coast this weekend.
Rain or shine, we walk the line.
A costly teacher strike in L.A.
The two sides are talking face-to-face for the first time since the walkout began on Monday. The new talks come at the urging of L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti. The walkout is impacting around 500,000 students at around 1,000 schools. The strike is also costing the school district millions of dollars each day, this because of reduced attendance, which determines how much funding the district receives. Steve Futterman, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Up next, the history already being made in campaign 2020 on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like Democratic Senator Mark Warner.
What we want to try to do is give the American people the truth.
Jim Bridenstine, administrator of NASA. How close are we to space tourism?
I think we're very close.
Trump cabinet member Linda McMahon.
First time that I met Donald Trump was at a Rolling Stones concert.
Politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
An historic number of women are announcing their intentions to run for president in 2020.
I'm going to run for president of the United States because as a young mom, I'm going to fight for other people's kids as hard as I would fight for my own.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand made it official Tuesday night on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Asked about the ongoing shutdown, she directly attacked her would-be opponent, President Trump.
He's created the problem himself. He's created this crisis himself. And he shouldn't be having a temper tantrum because he can't get what he wants.
I was the first member to publish
this. In a campaign video, Gillibrand makes clear that Mr. Trump will be central to her campaign.
I'm not afraid of him, and I'm not afraid of his nasty language and his name-calling.
What this president is doing is inhumane and immoral.
The 52-year-old joined the U.S. Senate in 2009, replacing Hillary Clinton, who had stepped down to serve as Secretary of State. Gillibrand joins a growing Democratic field that includes two men and one other woman, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts.
Rules matter. Rules made in Washington matter, and that's why I'm in this fight.
Three more women are also expected to join the race. There's Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard.
There are a lot of reasons for me to make this decision.
California Senator Kamala Harris is also on the verge of launching a campaign.
Do you have a timetable for making a decision?
Soon.
And then there's Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar.
I am taking my time. I had to talk to my family. They are on board.
Since the 2016 presidential election, women have been making their voices heard. They're protesting, donating money, and running for office in record numbers.
Ed O'Keefe reporting from Capitol Hill. Other 2020 Democratic candidates include former HUD Secretary Julian Castro. Increasing pressure on Iowa Republican Congressman Steve King to resign, including from those in his own party. It comes after a resolution meant to condemn racist remarks he's made passed nearly unanimously by the House.
I said all I'm going to say today.
Congressman King was informed by phone that he was being removed from the powerful Judiciary and Agriculture Committees. The decision was made by House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy and other top Republicans.
These are not the first time we've heard these comments.
It was in an interview with the New York Times that King appeared to show sympathy with racist ideologies, musing, quote, white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization. How did that language become offensive?
The terms are offensive because the concepts are evil.
Three House Democrats had submitted resolutions to officially admonish King, who argued his quote was misconstrued and that he opposes white supremacy. Leader McCarthy's decision to remove me from committees, he said, is a political decision that ignores the truth. But the nine-term conservative congressman has a history of racially insensitive comments, including this one about immigrants in 2013.
For everyone who's a valedictorian, there's another 100 out there that they weigh 130 pounds and they've got calves the size of cantaloupes because they're hauling 75 pounds of marijuana across the desert.
Now, Republican leaders like Senator Mitch McConnell are urging him to find another line of work.
He ought to resign and move on and let someone else who represents American values take his seat.
Nancy Cordes, CBS News, Washington.
Second Lady Karen Pence is under fire for her new job.
I call my initiative Art Therapy, Healing with the Heart.
Second Lady Karen Pence's decision to teach art part-time at Emmanuel Christian School in Northern Virginia has generated controversy. That's because the private elementary school's website says it may refuse admission or discontinue enrollment of a student if a parent or guardian violates a biblical lifestyle. Prohibited behavior includes participating in, supporting, or condoning homosexual activity. Likewise, employees, including teachers, can be fired for engaging in homosexual or lesbian activity or transgender identity. Those rules would appear to be consistent with the views of Vice President Mike Pence, a longtime critic of gay rights.
To defend that institution that forms the backbone of our society, traditional marriage.
Rules banning homosexuality are not uncommon at private Christian schools, and generally they do not violate the law.
Karen Pence is sending a message.
But law professor Evan Wolfson says the question is not what's legal, it's what's right for victims of discrimination.
This is the Second Lady of the United States cheering that discrimination and exclusion on.
A spokesperson for Karen Pence said in a statement, it's absurd that her decision to teach art to children at a Christian school and the school's religious beliefs are under attack. Emmanuel Christian School did not respond to our request for comment. Chip Reed, CBS News, Washington.
We're learning more about the man police say abducted a Wisconsin 13-year-old, Jamie Kloss, after killing her parents.
Jake Patterson only worked at Saputo Cheese Factory for 2 days, but according to a criminal complaint, it was on his drive to work on one of those days that he spotted Jamie Kloss getting on a school bus and decided he was going to kidnap her. The company told CBS News they fired Patterson when he failed to show up for his third day of work. According to the complaint, Patterson was plotting Jamie's abduction while still at the job. He bought a face mask at a Walmart on his last day, the same mask he allegedly wore during the October crimes. On Tuesday, Patterson was moved to the Polk County Jail because Jamie Kloss's cousin, Lindsay Smith, works at the Barron County Jail. Smith spoke about Patterson with Gail King earlier this week.
Have you seen him?
I have not. I will not deal with him. It's fair on my end and his that we do not see each other.
The Marine Corps confirms that in 2015, Patterson was prematurely discharged from service after about a month. A spokesperson said it was indicative of the fact that the character of his service was incongruent with Marine Corps expectations and standards. While investigators worked to determine Patterson's motive for the October crimes, the close-knit community that helped raise Jamie is beginning to heal. Patty Gerber taught Jamie's religious education class. She believes faith will help Jamie move forward.
Faith to know that she's loved by God, she's loved by others, she's perfect the way she is. I think that will help her.
Jamie Yucas, CBS News, Cameron, Wisconsin.
In Ohio, the state's Department of Health is opening an investigation into Mount Carmel hospitals after at least 27 patients died after receiving excessive doses of the opioid fentanyl. Remembering a victim killed in a deadly attack by Al-Shabaab in Nairobi, Kenya. Here's correspondent Deborah Pata.
Jason Spindler was one of the good guys, say his parents, a former investment banker who survived 9/11 because he was late for work that day. He later gave up a high-powered Wall Street career for the chance to make a difference.
Jason, once you met him, you knew that this guy was going to change the world.
That passion for change led him to Kenya, where with co-founder Patricia Chinsweeney, he started a company that aims to reduce poverty through investing in developing economies.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, new research on a plot that could have changed the course of American history.
It really happened. It was a secret plot to kill George Washington.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Brad Meltzer is a best-selling novelist. Now he's turning his attention to history. Brad joins us in studio here in Washington. Brad, you're right about the secret plot to kill
George Washington
in your book, The First Conspiracy. First, tell us about this plot. What happened?
Yeah, I found this story nearly a decade ago, and it really happened. It was a secret plot to kill George Washington. When George Washington found out about it, he rounded up those responsible. He grabbed one of the co-conspirators, built a gallows, and he hanged the man in front of 20,000 witnesses. It was the largest public execution at that point in North American history. It was George Washington bringing the hammer down. He said, "Don't mess with me. I'm George Washington. I'm going to be on the money one day," you know, is what he was saying. But I was really struck by why we didn't know this story. It begs the question: how is there a plot to kill George Washington? We've never heard about it. And if you look at when the hanging took place, it was on June 28th, 1776. Guess what else was happening in America the week before July 4th? And it was the first draft of the Declaration of Independence is being handed in. We see the British are literally coming, and in the midst of all this, and headlines like that, this hanging becomes a footnote to history and disappears.
How did this plot come together, and ultimately, what stopped it?
So it was a loyalist plot on the British side, of course, led by the governor of New York, a man named William Tryon. And he was very upset, of course, that he was out of power and the British were out of power, and he wanted his power back. The most interesting part of who was responsible was George Washington had his own bodyguards. He had asked at the start of the war all of his, he asked every regiment, said, "Give me four of your top men." He wanted the best of the best. And from those, he actually narrowed it down to about 50 men. And those became what were known as the General's Guards, the Commander's Guards. But really, the name that stuck was the Lifeguards, because they guarded George Washington's life. And these were the men who turned on George Washington. These were the ones who were plotting against him.
How did he find out?
To figure out this plot, he put together a secret committee. Was called the Committee on Conspiracies, was the eventual name they took on. And he put a man named John Jay in charge of it, who, of course, became our first Supreme Court justice. And John Jay, this small group of really what amounted to three people, went in the middle of the night, had midnight raids, and took witnesses and did interrogations. And what they were really doing is they were in the process of becoming America's first counterintelligence agency. Today, we think that the precursor to the CIA is the OSS. But in reality, it wasn't. It was this. It was this Committee on Conspiracies from the Revolutionary War. And to this day, right now in CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, there is a room dedicated to John Jay, who they call the father of counterintelligence. And it all stems from this plot, the plot to kill George Washington.
What do you think would have happened if this plot were successful, or if George Washington didn't make a public display about the consequences of those involved in the plot?
Yeah, it's interesting. George Washington actually never says that the plot, he never talks about it publicly at all. And I wish I can say we definitively know. We just don't. It's one of those parts that's a giant question mark. We don't know if it's because he wanted to keep it quiet. There are some who suggest it's because he wanted to put people off the trail. I personally think you never want to tell anyone when your own men turn against you. It's not really a great way to portray strength. One of the things that when I think of this moment, is we all love to think that the Revolutionary War was the Declaration of Independence and you know, there's a battle and George Washington's the president and then we win and the end. It's a happy ending for all. It was far more complex than that. Today, we are a nation that's divided, and it was no different back then. In 1776, in New York City, there were nearly as many loyalists on the British side as there were on the American side, on the Patriot side. And in our own military, it was the same division. You had the, you know, the, there's a scene in the book where you see the Massachusetts Regiment meets in Harvard Yard, the Virginia Regiment, and they get in this argument and a big fight breaks out between them. And George Washington comes riding in on his horse, grabs two of the men responsible and is shaking them and basically saying, stop fighting each other. We're on the same team. There were no United States back then. George Washington had to help will it into being by putting his arms around everyone, trying to pull us together. And so when you look at a plot like this now from a modern context, you can't help but see where we are today.
You wrote this book with documentary producer Josh Mensch. Why did you go from writing thrillers for all these years to nonfiction and particularly this subject?
The reason I brought Josh in is we used to do a TV show on the History Channel called Lost History. And we helped find the 9/11 flag that the firefighters raised at Ground Zero with this show. And Josh was the executive producer of the show. He was one of the most amazing researchers. And when we found the flag, full credit, you know, people always say, oh, Brad, your show brought back the credit. But Josh was the executive producer of that show. And his research was impeccable. And so I knew when we were tackling this, a new piece, or at least new in the sense that there's no modern book fully written on the subject, that we needed the research that was going to be incredible. He's an incredible researcher and writer. And as far as making the transition from thrillers, I've always, you know, I do a whole line of nonfiction books, the I Am books that we put out. I am Abraham Lincoln. I am Amelia Earhart. But I had never found a full-length adult topic that I felt like warranted a nonfiction book until I found this one. When I found this topic, I said, you know what, this is the first book I ever want to do that's completely nonfiction. It was just such a big topic. And something that really hadn't, it had been explored in any good Washington biography, has a few paragraphs or a couple pages on it, but no one had explored it at full book length in the modern time that we could find. And we just said, we have to tackle this thing.
Brad Meltzer in studio on the Weekend Roundup on his book, The First Conspiracy. Thank you, Brad.
Thank you, sir.
Now to New York, where the trial of Mexican drug kingpin El Chapo continues. It's where his former mistress revealed shocking details about the relationship and his escape from authorities in testimony. CBS News correspondent Anne-Marie Green has more.
A former Mexican lawmaker who was the alleged mistress of El Chapo revealed new details about the drug kingpin. She testified during his murder and drug trafficking trial in New York. 29-year-old Lucero Guadalupe Sanchez Lopez broke down crying. El Chapo's wife was in the courtroom. Lopez described how El Chapo allegedly lured her into drug trafficking. She also said that she was with the notorious drug lord when he escaped authorities by running through a tunnel hidden under his bathtub.
Another large group of Central American migrants has crossed Mexico's southern border, but as CBS's Adrian Bard tells us from Mexico City, this time they're being welcomed by the country's new government.
A few months ago, migrants stampeded the gate at Mexico's southern border and confronted federal police with tear gas. This time, a new group of more than 1,000 Central Americans was ushered in by immigration officers in jeans and baseball caps. The officials placed scannable ID bracelets on the migrants' wrists and then escorted them to register for temporary humanitarian visas created by Mexico's new government. They can apply for work permits, but most say their goal is to make it to the U.S. Adrian Bard, CBS News, Mexico City.
Coming up, pushing the cookie boundaries.
They have triple the filling of a regular Oreo.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up.
CBS News Special Report.
It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News with Jeff Glor.
We're going to begin with our interview with the president late this afternoon.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
A nearly three-decade-old double murder is meeting 21st-century sleuthing. In this weekend's 48 Hours, correspondent Richard Schlesinger is in New York to tell us more about it. Richard, first, tell us about the murders of Betty Jones and her friend Catherine Kriegler.
These were two senior citizens who were settling in for the evening to watch a baseball game. A knock came on the door. It was in a small town in Mississippi where people opened their doors. They did. And an intruder came in and killed both of them in no time. It was, as one of the investigators told me, as awful as anything Jack the Ripper ever did. It was that bad.
They went unsolved as murderers until a guy named Jason B. Jones got involved. Who was he?
Well, he's the step grandson of Betty Jones, one of the victims, who, you know, had always heard. I mean, he remembered his grandmother. She died when he was 10 years old, and he had always heard about her, but didn't know anything about the circumstances of the murder. And so he got curious and started investigating and started a podcast with the odd name of Knock Knock, after the fact that this whole thing began with a knock on the door. In fairness, though, I mean, the case never really died. I mean, there was a succession of police officers, and most recently one police officer in Starkville, Mississippi, who made this his mission and worked this case on his own time sometimes and would not give up. And he's the one who really got to the bottom of it all.
Well, what did he bring to this case that helped it break through?
Lieutenant Lott, who's the police officer I was talking about, he describes himself as a dinosaur who's still really interested in science. And so he kept up on DNA technology and advances in science and in that area, forensic science, and learned about this new, brand new technique for researching DNA and finding family members. It's called genetic genealogy. You may have heard of it. It was, if you remember the Golden State Killer, the guy out in California, that's how they found him. It's this painstaking, detailed research where they take one strand of DNA and they have to compare it to millions of people, hoping to find a distant relative that will lead them to their suspect.
The frontier of solving cold cases. 48 Hours correspondent Richard Schlesinger on the Weekend Roundup. You can catch 48 Hours Saturday nights on CBS or stream it anytime on CBS All Access. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
Now to new research on our financial stability.
Have you saved enough? Just under half of Americans don't track their spending against a budget, and a new study by Bankrate.com says 60% of us do not have enough savings to meet the unexpected expenses of $1,000. Bankrate's Mark Hamrick.
For whatever reason, Americans have not been able to or have not made savings a sufficient priority in their personal financial lives.
He says the partial government shutdown is a good example of what any of us could face at any given time. Matt Piper, CBS News.
Tesla cutting 7% of its workforce. Here's CBS News senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger.
It is not profitable, and it is really hard to burn through cash and innovate and not show results. So I think that Tesla has a responsibility to its shareholders and has now made this decision to cut its staff as it's trying to figure out how to sell enough electric vehicles in order to float this company.
An advancement in cookie science.
Are you a double stuff lover?
My best friend and an Oreo cookie.
Before you unscrew the chocolate wafers and scrape off the cream with your teeth, it gets better. Cookie lovers are sharing their joy on social media over brand new Oreo Most Stuffs. They have triple the filling of a regular Oreo. They're also more than double the 45 calories. One Most Stuff adds up to 110 calories. The price is $3 a box. The milk is on you. Deborah Rodriguez, CBS News.
One man's trash is another's remedy, according to one company.
Would you buy a box of pre-used tissues? I mean, tissue that a sick person has already sneezed in. Vave, a Los Angeles-based company, is marketing boxes of tissues that are guaranteed to already have been sneezed in. The idea is that the tissues will help you build up your immune system to ward off disease. But Vave admits it has no doctors on board to back up the concept. Its pre-sneeze tissues aren't cheap, about $80 a box. Jim Shenevy, CBS News.
Finally, this weekend, one of the great mysteries of World War II has been solved thanks to a daughter who never gave up and a remarkable mission to recover remains lost nearly 75 years ago. Jeff Glore reports.
I just got little pieces here and there, people talking about them, cousins, my grandmother.
Marla Andrews was just 2 years old when her father died serving his country.
This is your tribute to him.
Yes. These flying medals have oak leaf clusters on them. Each cluster designates 13 missions, so that's how we know that he had 68 missions.
Captain Lawrence Dixon's plane crashed over Austria in December 1944. He was one of the Tuskegee Airmen, the legendary all-black pilot unit. 27 of them have never been found. Dixon's wife, Marla Andrews' mother, wrote to the military at the time looking for answers. For more than 70 years, nothing.
I think, like most people, the fact that you can't find out what you want to know immediately makes you crazy.
Last summer, a breakthrough. Andrews got a call from the Pentagon, but they needed her help. A researcher discovered eyewitness reports from around the time of the crash with enough clues to point investigators to a site where they found wreckage matching Dixon's plane, along with artifacts and bone fragments. They asked Andrews for a DNA sample. It was a match.
What about what you've learned has surprised you?
Little things surprised me, like when they found the artifacts, among them were part of a harmonica, and it made me laugh. This guy was the bomb. He couldn't take his electrical guitar with him in the plane. He took his harmonica. How smart is that?
That's great.
They also found his ring.
This one has the initials of my mother and my father and a heart in the middle with an arrow. Mm. How romantic is that?
Today, Marla Andrews continues to honor her father by keeping the legacy alive for her children, his grandchildren.
I'm his representative and his protector. The children, when they got older, would know that they had somebody in the family who had functioned in a very honorable way.
I bet your dad would be proud of you.
I think he'd be proud that his legacy went beyond me.
Jeff Glore reporting.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Jake Rosen is the intern. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.